Renewable Heat Inquiry has heard more startling evidence. The panel was told about a stand-up row in a London restaurant involving an executive minister and his advisor before a meeting at Whitehall. It involved the DUP minister, Jonathan Bell, the former DUP minister, Jonathan Bell. He fell out with his special advisor at the time, Timothy Kearns, over perceived interference in his decision-making from other DUP figures. Here's counsel to the inquiry, David Schofield, QC.
One of the things that you will see from the evidence is that there is, I think it's fair to say, an extremely difficult relationship between Mr. Kearns and Minister Bell, at least at various points in the period that we're going to be looking at. So the evidence recounts that there was a trip to London on the 9th and 10th of June in order to have a meeting with the Secretary of State for DEC on the 10th of June. I think it was Amber Rudd at that stage. And it seems that there was a heated discussion between Mr. Bell and Mr. Kearns on the evening of the 9th of June. I think that was over dinner in an Indian restaurant. To add a little colour to what happens then. There's then a further altercation at which some of the officials are present, at least for part of it, the next morning at a breakfast briefing before they go to meet the Secretary of State.
And somebody leaves that meeting, don't they?
Well, that becomes very heated. I think the evidence is at that stage that a number of the officials, for instance the Permanent Secretary, and others are asked to leave the table. Yeah. The debate continues, and then
this is at the breakfast.
Yes, it seems that Mr. Kearns was then told by Minister Bell that he wasn't coming to the meeting, and Mr. Kearns then asked the private secretary, Mr. Kerr, to book him a flight, and he flew home. So he didn't go to the meeting, and he's then off for a period. Now, as I say, there's probably quite a lot of the circumstances around that that the panel may have to look at to some degree in order to understand whether and if so how that impacted on what was happening with the RHI scheme. And in fact, the evidence tends to suggest that the heated disagreement, both on the 9th of June and on the 10th of June, related to one of the issues that the panel is going to be considering. That is to say, the extent to which Minister Bell was entitled to make decisions himself without recourse to ministerial colleagues in the DUP. Now, in that context, I think it was particularly in relation to the NARU, which is what the officials were going to speak to DEC about, rather than about the RHI, although there's also some evidence to suggest that in the disagreement on the 9th of June, RHI was part of the mix. So bringing all of that together, there's plainly a disagreement between Minister Bell and Mr. Kearns in London on the 9th and 10th of June. Mr. Kearns is, it seems, sent home. He's not working with the Minister then for a period of several weeks and comes back into the department on the 29th of June. And you'll recall that that's when Mr. Kearns says, following his period of sick leave, there is this meeting with Mr. Johnson, at which both Minister Bell and Mr. Kearns are present, when arrangements are discussed as to how things will proceed from then on.
You used the word, I think if I heard it correctly earlier on, that he was dismissed. Was Mr. Kearns sacked or not? Or is that not relevant?
Well, I'll urge a note of caution about the use of that word. And that might be my word. I'm not sure if that's a word which is used in the evidence. But at any rate, it seems clear that the minister was insistent that the special advisor would not be attending the meeting. And that led to, it seems, a breakdown in the relationship, which also led to Mr. Kearns not being present as the special advisor in the department for a period of time. As I say, there's a reasonable amount of detail about that, particularly in some of the evidence from Dr. McCormick, I think Mr. Stewart, but I wasn't intending to open the details of any of that at this particular stage.
Okay.
Well, let's talk to the newsletter's political editor, Sam McBride, about this. Good morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen.
Well, Sam, when I was investigating the whole RHI story, It's over a year ago now, isn't it? I saw among some of the papers we had and some of the evidence we had this this whole London restaurant scenario, and it's like something out of a novel.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's a pretty lurid picture when you listen to it. There, David Schofield QC is setting it out in a pretty straight manner, but this is the sort of thing which is just extraordinary to you think that this is what was going on between two of the key people in this saga at the point where, let's remember, the scheme was running out of control. So this was summer of 2015. The scheme had since spring of that year been known to the department to be seriously problematic. They were trying to clarify the budget position. They knew that they didn't have enough money to cover it at that point. There was still a bit of uncertainty about that. And the officials were starting to work on putting in cost controls belatedly. At this point, we have this situation where the minister and his spat are having a stand-up row before a major meeting with the UK minister who was responsible for the Great Britain RHI scheme, also for some other big renewable policies which were going on at that point, which the department was working on. And to the extent that the minister sends his spad home, or his spad sends himself home after he's told that he's not going to be going to this meeting. And then elsewhere in the evidence, which we heard on Friday, was this picture painted by the spad, Timothy Turns, of Jonathan Bell as somebody who rarely read briefing papers, rarely dissented from the advice that was put before him. The picture which emerged was really the minister who rubber-stamped what was put in front of him.
I'm sure Jonathan Bell would have something to say about that.
I'm sure he will when he comes to the inquiry, and we're getting little pieces and glimpses of the evidence. We're not seeing it in its full context, but from what David Schofield told the inquiry, you really have to wonder if this was a minister who was very reliant on his officials, the very idea that he would send home one of the key people who, as a temporary civil servant and as his appointed temporary civil servant, ought to be the key person giving him advice before a big meeting like this. I mean, it's an extraordinarily dysfunctional picture of what was going on at the point when these people ought to have been really getting on top of the emerging difficulty in the RHI scheme.
Yeah, a lot of people felt, Sam, that you know, well, some people, let me be more accurate, some people felt that what this RHI inquiry would do would be to shine a light on what Arlene Foster did or didn't do. What this is also doing, Sam, very clearly what this is doing, is it is shining a light on the DUP and what they got right, what they got wrong, but more interestingly, how their party works, the mechanisms behind the bonnet.
That's right. And for both the DUP and Sinn Féin, the key to their success in many ways is a very centralised structure. There is really iron discipline a lot of the time. They like secrecy. They don't like things getting out. And what we're seeing here is something which, because of that background where we often don't know exactly what's going on, this has added potency, I suppose, as a story. And one of the questions out of the clip that we heard there is whether this is just part of the normal desire of a party in this context to have a single coherent policy and something. So Jonathan Bell and his spad were apparently rowing in this restaurant and then over breakfast the next day over whether he had the ability as a minister to take a decision about renewable energy without recourse to the wider party. Is that something which is just part of the normal structure of any party where they're trying to keep things together, trying to have everybody on the same page? Or is this something much more centralised, much more about decisions being taken at the top, so that actually the minister in a department is not really the final decision maker, even though by law they are ultimately accountable for what goes on? So there are all sorts of questions which this throws up, not just about what went on here or even just what was going on within the DUP at that point, but about how the DUP and how the executive functions today, if it comes back, or tomorrow if it comes back to take over from the vacuum at the moment.
How do you feel that the DUP centrally will be viewing the RHI inquiry so far?
Well, I think, I mean, at the start of this, I know that some people in the DUP were really taking the view that the civil service had taken such a pounding in the opening months of the inquiry, repeated revelations about just extraordinary incompetence. Many civil servants accepting that what they had put in front of Arlene Foster had at various points been either misleading or inaccurate or had in some other way misled her in terms of her early key decisions about this. But I think really some people in the DUP looked at that and thought almost the job's done from their point of view. There is such a tsunami of evidence against the civil service that really endorses Arlene Foster's view right from the start that it wasn't her fault, that really she was let down by her officials. What we're seeing since then is that once the inquiry has moved on from dissecting what the civil servants did, now moving into the party, and that is deeply uncomfortable. I think in Dundella Avenue they will have been glued to this last week. I think there'll be a lot of concern about what's coming out. Some of what we heard on Friday is about evidence of text messages which have been compelled by the inquiry. These are messages between special advisers, which in one instance revealed that Andrew Crawford, the long-standing adviser to Arlene Foster, was furious about his situation at the start of last year, as this was really at its zenith in terms of the public nature of the scandal. And he really felt that Arlene Foster, his former minister, his former boss, had hung him out to dry over the issue. So we're getting an incredible insight into how people within the DUP at the very top not just operate in terms of how they relate to civil servants, but how they relate to each other and how they speak about things when they're in the middle of a crisis.
We're taking this in, and I don't mean this to be patronising to the public at all. We're taking this in because we had a deep interest in the story and it was our job to have a deep interest in the story. Do you think the public are engaged with the RHI inquiry and what's coming out of it?
I think they are, and I think we've got evidence for that in the sense that certainly in terms of our website, we can actually track how people are reading stories, which stories they're reading, how long they're reading them for, and consistently there is just enormous interest in this. I think that probably differs. I think there is more interest when it's something which relates to the DUP or something that's particularly scandalous or particularly incompetent, if it's a civil servant or somebody else. That's human nature. That's understandable. A lot of people will not be following this on a day-to-day basis. But I think there are so many people who are actually at some level involved in this. If you're a member of the civil service, for instance, this is something which touches on your job. There are going to be recommendations out of this inquiry which will really shape how government operates in Northern Ireland. So there are so many people who have got some sort of personal interest in this. And then there is a huge swathe, I think, of the public. They are just looking aghast at this. And in the context of not having Stormont, in the context of the public, I suppose, being asked to consider what compromises they want their politicians to make to get Stormont back, this is hugely significant because it shows them what Stormont was doing when it was in operation. This isn't the full picture of Stormont. Not everything in Stormont was as incompetent as this. Of course it wasn't. But this is giving us a snapshot of how some of these key people operated. And I think it's a pretty ugly picture for the most part.
Sam, you mentioned key people. Andrew Crawford, some of his evidence has been widely reported by yourselves and the newsletter and indeed ourselves here and other media organisations. We put a question into both the DUP. Andrew Crawford is a researcher now for the DUP MEP, Diane Dodds. And we put a question in on Friday asking both the DUP and indeed Diane Dodds if they still had confidence in Andrew Crawford after we learnt about the documents that he inappropriately released to the then First Minister's son, Peter Robinson's son, Gareth Robinson. And neither the DUP nor Diane Dodds have got back to us to say they have confidence in Andrew Crawford.
It's maybe not surprising that they haven't answered that question in those terms, because who is going to want at this point to put their hand up and associate themselves with someone who is involved in what has been or was involved in what has been revealed at the inquiry? Having said that...
Well, he continues to be a researcher for Diane Dodds.
That's a key point, and I think they clearly are demonstrating their confidence in him by continuing to employ him. This is a very centralised party. It is a party where I think if the leadership made clear that somebody was not suitable or was in some way damaging the party, I think it would be made very clear to those who were directly employing him. And of course, the person who's directly employing him here is the wife of the deputy leader. I think it would be very surprising if the party did not have confidence in him if they're employing him, and particularly employing him on research which Arlene Foster told the inquiry was in some way linked to the party's Brexit policy. I mean, that's a very significant area in which to give somebody responsibility at this point. I think it's very clear that the party still retains confidence in him.
Final question, Sam. Like, I am glued to the RHI inquiry. I watch the RHI inquiry more than I watch, you know, box sets on Netflix. That's how sad I am. It's really interesting stuff. And Sir Patrick Coughlin and his team and the QCs, is this how inquiries usually work, Sam? Or are they performing above the norm in terms of the evidence they're getting and the approach they're taking? I guess I'm asking, are they really, really good at what they do? Or is this how all inquiries unfold? Because they seem to be prizing evidence out on a phenomenal scale.
I'm afraid you're probably asking me a question which is beyond my expertise in terms of other inquiries. I think that the key to their success here, yes, is the ability of the people, their diligence, the amount of work they've done, that they've gone through, the inquiry staff and the inquiry team have gone through 1.3 million pages of documentation and evidence as they're piecing this story together. But the absolute crux of this is the powers of the inquiry. This inquiry has sweeping powers. They can go in and compel private companies, individuals, to hand over text messages, to hand over WhatsApp chats, to hand over all sorts of material, and to compel people to come before the inquiry and just sit there for as long as it takes to get the evidence. And you know from your programme how important it is to have the time where somebody can't just stonewall for a few minutes and actually get to the truth. This is, I suppose, the Nolan show on steroids, in the sense that there are.
I'm sure Sir Patrick will like that.
Well, I mean, it's a different form of question, but I mean, it is just a timeless ability to really get to the truth here. And I think one of the questions here is why Sinn Féin was so opposed to this. So it's very obvious why the DUP wouldn't want this level of inquiry, and nobody would want this level of scrutiny of a scandal in which one had some involvement. But you will recall that for weeks at the height of this scandal, Sinn Féin was very reluctant to get involved in this. And I mean, I'm still curious about that and whether that was linked to anything direct in terms of something they were concerned would come out. Perhaps not.
We have no evidence of that.
That is correct. And I think perhaps the answer is that it was a wider fear that this would really show Stormin to be so dysfunctional, not in a way that maybe directly implicated Sinn Féin, but something which in a tangential way they had some responsibility for or could be seen to have some responsibility for. And really now what we're seeing is something that none of these politicians have any control over. It is taking on a life of its own, and it's really, I think, demonstrating a pretty robust determination to get to the bottom of what actually happened here, regardless of who that annoys.